Hi, and welcome to the Massage Matters podcast. I'm Becky DeMott Horton, and I'm joined by my lovely massage collective friends and colleagues, Anna Maria Mazzieri and Matt Scarsbrook. Kick off today, just want to say a massive thank you to all of you that got in touch after the last podcast talking about the lockdown and how that affected us. It was really nice to hear so many of you contribute with your thoughts and feelings around it. And it's nice to know that the podcast was helpful to you, some of you in some ways. And it also started lots of really interesting conversations that have got us thinking over the last couple of weeks. A lot of centered around our scope of practice and where we fit within the profession and within musculoskeletal care in general. And that led us to thinking that's probably far more than just one podcast. So we've decided to, probably in our normal haphazard, disorganized way, have a series of podcasts based around what our scope of practice is, what our core skills are, what we really need to be focusing on as clinicians. So we're going to kick that off today talking about red flags. What we mean by red flags, how we can be on top of recognizing them, and why they form a fundamental part of being a good clinician. So make yourselves comfy, grab a brew, and we'll get started.
So yeah, as Becky's just mentioned, this is going to be the first in probably a bit of a mini series discussing things like scope of practice, the concept around that, and touching on the differences between what we mean by diagnosis and what we mean by assessment, and where that fits into our roles as massage therapists. Now, this series is highly unlikely to be consecutive because we're just not that organized, but this is essentially started because we are teachers, as I think you know, and we have recently done some a course where we were talking about red flags in soft tissue therapy. And actually what came out of that was some really, really ace questions that really made us stop and think, perhaps even more than we had previously. And we want to sort of take those thoughts and the questions that came up and address them over this sort of series of podcasts, because if the questions were being asked in that forum, then no doubt those questions are in the minds of lots of other massage therapists as well. So we're going to start today with looking at red flags and what we mean by red flags and what we probably ought to know about red flags in our role as massage therapists. And so in the way that we like to make sure that that we're providing kind of key points for people to go away with, what we want to start with is the point for us which probably overrides everything, or underwrites everything that we do, which is that you need to be a good clinician. So, Becky, Anna, what do we mean when we say you need to be a good clinician?
I think what we're talking about there is doing the very best for our clients, being client-centered. And by being client-centered, we have to, as well as all the other fantastic things we do, like being well-read around injury and pain education, actually, first and foremost, we need to make sure that we're safe in the knowledge that we are alert to anything that should be being referred, and that actually might indicate something that is a little bit more serious than we should be dealing with. And essentially, it comes down to keeping our clients safe, and being aware that wherever we sit within the massage, soft tissue therapist, sports therapist profession, people quite often come to us as a first port of call. You know, if they're in pain, if they're injured, if they're not sure, we quite often see them first. And I think for me, being a good clinician is being that filter, if you like, and having the breadth of knowledge to know, is there something going on here that means that I'm not the right person to to help this client at this time, or that, you know, I might be the right person to help them, but that also I need them to see something, somebody else. So it's, yeah, for me, it's being well informed enough about what you're looking for and being confident to refer that person on as and when required.
And not necessarily only when we think that they have a red flags, but also when we think that our skill set and our approach and our training does not fulfill the needs of those clients. And that's why we cannot use our clients as guinea pigs. You know, we cannot go to a forum says, oh, you know, how would I treat that? Well, in the moment in which you're asking me that, it means actually you haven't got the skill set to treat it. Should you be treating the client? So being a good clinician is really, Becky, you just hit a really, really good point there where you say, you know, being understanding what the client needs, what he needs and where, you know, where the line is of should I be treating it, should I not? And it's the clinical thinking and clinical reasoning, which is very important. So being a good clinician, having good, strong clinical reasoning.
And for me, practically, the first thing I guess that looks like for me is that you're well informed as a therapist. You don't have to be, you know, I'm not saying we all need to be GPs all of a sudden, absolutely not. But we need to be well informed about what are the things we should be looking out for? What are those red flags that should ring those alert bells for us? So that at any time when we're with a client, whether it's a client that we see once a month, they come to us for their nice relaxing massage, or whether it's a client that's come to us with potentially an injury or some sort of chronic pain, we're always at the forefront of our mind all the time is something ringing alarm bells for me? Is there something here that I should be referring on or discussing with the client? And it comes back to me as well that Anna, you've touched on it so many times, that therapeutic alliance, and we're often in such a privileged position with our clients that they probably tell us far more than they do anybody else. You know, we might be the first person that they mention something to, and it would be really remiss of us if that was something that was indicative of a red flag and we didn't pick up on it in that situation. But that means we have to be well enough informed and we have to be confident to then go on to have what might be a little bit of a tricky conversation with somebody.
Yeah, that tricky conversation piece is really, really important, because there's no point you thinking, well, that doesn't quite sound right, but perhaps I haven't got enough information here to know, and yet be awkward or embarrassed around perhaps asking the types of questions that are needed to better inform yourself. So well informed, I think, is probably two parts, isn't it? It's well informed the minute you step into the room. You've already got your background knowledge from your training and from your continuous learning, but then it's also making sure that you understand how to become well informed through your subjective and objective assessments with the client, to make sure that the information is relevant, current, and complete, by not sort of skimming over bits that might be a bit awkward. And of course, you know, when we refer to awkward questions, you might be sat there thinking, well, what kind of awkward questions? But let's pick Corder Equina syndrome, which is being discussed very widely at the moment, as it should be within musculoskeletal care. And some of the symptoms there involve changes in bowel and bladder, sexual function, paresthesia around the saddle region. These are all areas that need discussing with the client, but can feel, in that kind of one-to-one scenario, particularly if they're a new client, awkward. But we kind of need to get over ourselves in that scenario and make sure that those questions are being asked so that we don't miss what is fundamentally a very, very urgent referral. Now, we're not going to go into any detail, I don't think, about specific red flags. We'll be here all day. But that is an example, I guess, about what we mean about the confidence.
And I'd go a little bit further than that, Matt. I mean, that's a very... obvious example of a conversation that might be awkward from the nature of the questions, but I think it goes a little bit deeper than that. You know, it's sometimes it's a client's come in and you've just noticed they're very tired, you know, or they're mentioning to you that they're suddenly not sleeping very well, or they've lost quite a lot of weight, and all these things. They can be quite personal conversations, and it might be a situation where they're thinking, I've only come in for a massage. Why am I suddenly having a conversation about, you know, my medical history, sleep patterns, my diet, you know. So I think any conversation around these red flags has the potential to be challenging, especially if it is a client with a medical history that they may well be a bit nervous about any kind of picking up on other symptoms. So I think we need to just not be too focused on those ones that are obviously, you know, sometimes embarrassing questions for somebody to deal with, but actually be mindful that any of those conversations might be tricky for you. You know, I'm sure we've all got those clients who just don't want to talk to you very much. But again, if you're well informed as a therapist and you have those skills to communicate well with your clients, but also you're well informed enough to, if they say, well, why are you suddenly asking about that, you can give them the context to that question.
I think sometimes they get missed, and we're not talking about big red flags like the equina that Matt was talking about, but just let's call it smaller red flags or smaller conditions that could have been referred, especially inflammatory conditions where referral is really important to be done timely. Sometimes they get missed because I think as therapists, we tend to be complacent with the symptoms, especially us a little bit more experienced. We tend to still separate and compartmentalize too much the symptoms from the person. We are not yet putting those symptoms into the framework of to the context of that person, because some symptoms by themselves they might sound red flags, but actually when you put them into the context of the person, the way they live, the way they their daily activity and the way they feel, that is no red flags anymore, while instead some others actually might sound completely innocuous symptoms, but actually if you put it together with again the context, I'm not been feeling very well, I'm actually feeling quite fluid recently, I'm losing a little bit of weight, and that might be an indication. So I think sometimes we miss them, those less emergency red flags, because we become too complacent. And when we say red flags, to pick a red flag up, it doesn't have to be, it's a continuous process. So it's not only the first time they come in, oh, they haven't got red flags, let's get on with it. Actually, sometimes all the clients expand themselves a little bit further in the follow-up session. So even, to be honest, they develop them after. So it's really important that we become a little bit, again, better clinicians by always being very alert.
And I think, Anna, perhaps that's where some of the feedback we got in terms of before we ran the course and then after the course is that where this is something that therapists really worry about, because it's so nuanced, isn't it? It's so, you know, I said it, funnily enough, when we were doing some research around it, I was like, oh, I'm just going to refer every single one of my clients, because you could see, you know, you could find a red flag in everybody if you looked hard enough, couldn't you? So it's, and I think that's perhaps where it's become a bit daunting for therapists, is it's like, well, how on earth do I find a way through this? How do I sort the wheat from the chaff, if you like? And how do I know who and when to refer? And I think that's complex.
I totally agree. And I think understanding, even acknowledging that it's complex, is probably a good start when it comes to being a good clinician, because I think having an awareness of the complexity allows you to marry that or compare that to your scope of practice, which is for me one of the fundamentals of being a good clinician. It's staying within your scope of practice, because, you know, to coin a phrase that Becky's used previously, we're not doing anyone any favors when we start working outside of our scope of practice. We might feel we are. We might think that we can just provide a little bit more insight for the client, and we're not. We're not being helpful at all, because if we're working outside of our scope of practice, there is a very strong possibility we're wrong, and it can be really bad to be wrong. Surprise, surprise. And so, you know, we've touched on qualifications before, and that's not what this is about. But obviously, remembering that actually our scope of practice is defined by our base qualification, not the CPDs that we take, because it's the base qualification that is actually examined, is tested, where the CPDs that we take are not. And so, our scope of practice, it comes back to that base qualification. So I think sort of taking a look back then at this sort of first point for us, which is it's super important to just generally be a good clinician. Slight segue that I want to pick up on, and it was one of Anna's earliest points, and there wasn't a good opportunity to jump in with it. So I'm going to jump in now before we move on to our next point. But Anna made the point that not only do you need to be sort of well-informed as a practitioner working with the client, but actually you need to ask yourself the question, am I the right practitioner for this client? And for me, that's particularly important as well, because you can be the right qualification of practitioner, but if your style of teaching, because fundamentally here we are sort of teaching our clients in certain scenarios, or our preferences for communication perhaps don't marry up with the preferences of our client, then as the recipient of information or as the recipient of communication, then actually perhaps we're not the best therapist. And I think being a good clinician is recognizing when your particular style is not the style that's going to be most beneficial for that client, and being comfortable to refer them on, not necessarily to someone with higher qualifications than you, could be someone of the same level or perhaps even lower, but because they have a skill set of communication that's going to be most important for the client. As I say, bit of a segue, but it's a bit that I really...
I think it's a really good point, Matt. And I'd just say to that takes a lot of confidence. And, you know, if you're sat there listening to this now and thinking, oh, maybe I haven't always done that, don't beat yourself up too much, because I think it takes a lot of feeling secure in yourself to sit there with a client and say, I don't think I'm the right person to do this. And I know I fell into that trap when I was a fairly newly qualified therapist. I worked, you know, with a couple of people that I kind of knew at heart I wasn't the best person to treat, but you're so scared, I think, when you first start, that if I admit that, I'm admitting that I'm not very good as a therapist, or I can't do my job, or, you know, the other therapist that I refer them to is just going to realize that I'm rubbish and they're going to take all my clients, you know. So it takes a real ability to step back and look objectively at yourself as a therapist in terms of what type of therapist you are, what your scope of practice is, and also what your particular skill set is, to then go, actually, I'm confident enough to refer you on. And, you know, I'm sure we can all say from personal experience, when you actually start doing that, it's hugely beneficial to you from a business point of view more than anything else, because you're respected as somebody who will put the client at the heart of everything that you do.
That's the benefit of working in a clinic environment.
Yeah.
I, you know, when you teach and the students, they do their calculations and they think, oh, it's much better if I work from home. Excuse me. Well, the finances may look better when you work from your front room, but what you're missing, what you're not gaining, is a tremendous amount of support. It's the ability to bounce ideas and sometimes those red flags, suspected red flags, with our colleagues into the clinic. And even if you're not working in a clinic environment, like you correctly said, Becky, let's get a referral path, an open referral pathway or an open communication channel with our local GP practices, local osteopath, chiropractor or physiotherapist. So that's how we can really learn, and but also, you know, get ourselves around that table with those professionals, which is good. But we know that the problem is there. What my question is always, what can we do at practitioner level, but also at governance level, at professional association level, to improve that? Should we be obviously it's important including them in the main qualification, but should we make sure that our students always have a yearly update on red flags? So what can it be, what can we suggest our professional associations to do in order to improve?
Yeah, I actually think, Anna, there's a good point to be made for looking at how it's taught on the original qualification. And I know I've seen a lot of courses where it is taught as black and white. And it is, you know, right, this morning we're going to cover red flags. These are your red flags. This is where you refer to. And you know, it's also taught as part of that initial consultation, which, you know, like Matt said, we're all tutors as well. And there has to be some form of structure to your educating. And that's the obvious place where it sits. But I think from the very start, people need to be taught that these are sometimes complex, that we're looking at the person as a whole, and these are a cluster, quite often a cluster of red flags, if you like. That it's an ongoing process.
You'll see them as a thread that follows throughout the whole interaction with the client. And that is interaction both for that hour, but for all the consecutive sessions that you're dealing with them, and having that constant thread weaved in the same way that you would, if you were moving into kind of a rehab kind of way, you would have a thread where you would be like, well, this is where I want to be, and I've backtracked to where we are now, and this is my proposed way I'm getting there. You'd be following that thread through. Well, I think you need to have this thread of constant low level awareness of how does that fit in with the pattern that they've explained before. Is that raising a flag for me, or actually in the context, does it make complete sense and actually I'm comfortable continuing? And you're right, Becky, I think that probably is a different way of presenting it in a teaching environment.
I think also that as we every year we need to present and renew, or every 3 years we need to present and renew our first aid. I think part of first aid for us should be red flags.
Sorry, Matt. I was just going to say, I think you're right, Anna. There's a really interesting point there from a governance or a professional organisation to say, actually, you know, this is specifically a CPD you need to show within the last 3 years or whatever. I also think we need to take some responsibility as individual therapists. And if, you know, somebody, like you say, Anna, somebody walks into your clinic and you're thinking, I've never come across this before, that's a nice trigger for you to go, right, I'm going to go and research this. I'm going to find a CPD for it. You know,
overwhelmed or surprised, and positively overwhelmed, obviously, but surprised how the interest when we decided to do the red flags. I was not expecting it, and lots of them said on the chat, they said yes, it was a great refresher. But some of them, they fear of missing something important. You can see it being big part of their reasoning. And for some people, was quite refreshing to see what should go down for as a red flags. But I was really surprised, which made me think we are not clear yet.
Yeah, I agree.
We are not clear yet.
So I suppose then I'm going to jump in with my big we've covered. We've gone a little bit off topic there, but that's just what we do when we talk. And this is insight to the way our brains work as well. You know, we're not only teachers and we're not only practitioners, but we really care for the industry and where the industry goes and how we can improve. So, if we take the basis that underwriting everything that we do is we're going to be a good clinician first, and we've gone through what we think that means to us. Probably the next bit to answer, because we've used the term a lot, but we've not yet defined it. What is a red flag?
So there's actually quite a nice definition in a paper by Briggs et al. That a red flag is a clinical indicator of possible serious underlying conditions requiring further medical intervention, which is a really long and wordy way of saying it's a symptom or a sign that might be present that should ring alarm bells for us that there might just possibly be something more serious going on. It's not a diagnostic tool. It's not a special test, or it doesn't give us any conclusive information. But at our level of scope of practice, it's exactly that. It's an alarm bell that this might be something more than a straightforward MSK pain.
And so, again, thinking of the kind of language that's often used in teaching and well, frankly, across all courses and the industry as a whole, what's that relative to a contraindication?
They overlap, certainly, and we can understand why there's confusion there. The way I would separate them out is actually the kind of dictionary definition of contraindication, if you like, which is that because of something that client has, or their medical history, or their current presenting picture, they are not suitable for your treatment. So they're, you know, the obvious example is somebody walks in with a streaming cold. It's not a sign of a serious pathology necessarily, although that might be slightly different right now, but generally it's not. But they are not suitable for your treatment right now, and that treatment might be detrimental to their current condition. A red flag
to you or your clinic.
Absolutely, to you, your clinic, the rest of your clients, absolutely.
Yeah. If you give someone with a fever a massage, it's not likely to make the fever worse. But if that's infectious, you get it and then you pass it on to the rest of your clients, that's a contraindication, obviously, but for slightly different reasons, perhaps. So
yeah. So then the distinction I draw with a red flag is that it doesn't necessarily preclude them from treatment, from your type of treatment. But it is something that is indicative of something more serious going on and you would want to refer. Now, there are certainly times when a red flag is a contraindication for treatment and it wouldn't be appropriate to treat. And this, again, comes down to us having a nice, broad understanding of all these different types of symptoms and what they may or may not indicate, and whether they sit in both camps or just one or the other. But I think, Anna, you defined it really nicely, is that actually with a contraindication, we're saying that there might be some detrimental effect from our treatment, either to us or the client. With a red flag, actually, what's likely to cause the detrimental outcome is not referring them, is missing a referral. So that for me, if that makes sense, is the clear definition there, is that a red flag, the potential damage we could do is in missing a referral.
And I think it's quite interesting as well. And I'm only going to throw this in because I find it interesting. But when we talk about red flags, actually, we hear about that. We hear that term come up quite a lot. And you'll even in primary healthcare, you'll hear discussion about flags. But there's also lots of different coloured flags. And it's probably worth being aware of just broadly speaking, what might be referred to as a black flag or a blue flag or a yellow flag. And in fact, some of these I only recently came to understand. And so previously, my understanding was that a yellow flag was more sort of the psychosocial element. So if we're saying a red flag is an underlying biological pathology, Then a yellow flag would be there's a psychosocial aspect here that may be contributing to this person's experience that we might need to take into account. So, for example, an underlying mental health condition, which may be exacerbating either their behaviors or their experience of pain, or whatever else that's just kind of making life more challenging for them. And yes, I was recently told by my wife, so I'm going to quote her, and if I'm wrong, then we'll blame my wife, that yellow flags now in certain scenarios are actually split even further down into blue and black flags, where blue is specifically the psychological, the mental health side of things, and black flags are the social economic side of things. So it's where you start taking into account someone's background, perhaps where they live, their heritage, perhaps their racial background, all those kind of aspects which may impact on the type of treatment or the type of responses that you'll get as a result. And so
I can't imagine why anybody gets confused over this stuff.
I know, right?
It's so simple.
Everyone loves colors, and
we need to be careful not to identify people as flags. I think a fantastic Ben Cormack wrote a post about it sometimes, and he said it was about that. Let's look at the person and not the flags they come in with. But it's really important. Yeah, but it's.
Flags for him with a little sandcastle going, well, today I'm feeling this one.
But it's that I think there's still it's the only system we have to identify if in certain cases we need to refer or not. And I think the psychological ones as well, because something is about having your psychosocial influence in your musculoskeletal injury. Something is, well, I'm picking up that there is a mental health issue where it needs to be referred to.
Sorry, Becky, you go.
No, I was just going to say, I think that speaks to our scope of practice as well. And there's certainly a lot of debate in the literature about how red flags should be used. But I would comment that literature is normally aimed towards primary healthcare or certainly healthcare professionals. And again, how reliable it is in that setting is certainly open for debate. I think for us as within our scope of practice, it's a fairly useful framework to alert us to somebody that needs to be referred. And I think we need to remain, if you do go off from this and do some reading around it, just bear in mind that a lot of that stuff is aimed at a healthcare professional who will have more diagnostic skills than we do, so may be able to go slightly further into those red flags than we are. And that's where that debate comes up about how useful are they. But I think for us, actually, for me as a practitioner, I certainly think they're really useful. It gives me a nice framework to work within. There's things that I'm always alert to, and it also gives me a way of communicating to the person that I'm referring you on to, because I can say, look, there's just a couple of things in this person's case history that are concerning me that I consider to be red flags, and that's a communication that we can share.
And you've totally stolen my point. so eloquently, as usual. Yeah, no, exactly that. For me, multicolored flags, absolutely. We shouldn't be identifying someone as they walk in through the door by the color of flag that they're wearing. But they are absolutely useful as a communication tool between practitioners who understand the context within which we would be using them. I've just repeated what you said, but I thought it. You made it, and I thought I'd really.
It was such a good point, it needed to be reconsolidated.
Absolutely. Which then, probably neatly, I hope, brings us on to our theory to practice. So each episode of this podcast, we really like to be able to give you something tangible that you can take away and use immediately. And we like to call that little tidbit theory to practice. Now, we totally appreciate that at the moment a vast majority of you like us are in some form of lockdown at the moment, and so the opportunities to see clients face to face is essentially zero. But we think that when it comes to things like red flags, they are just as important to be considering, if not more so, when working with clients in that online consultation capacity, which a number of you might be taking part in at the moment. So with that in mind, we're going to touch on how red flags can be assessed, in particular in the subjective assessment. For that, I'm going to hand over to Anna Maria.
That's where is subjective assessment, the initial interview, is one of the most important part, certainly in my view, of your role assessment, because in those questions where you're going to be profiling the injury, but also profiling the person with the injury, that those very important cues might come out. Is when you've been looking at their medical history or the family medical history, where you're going to be asking the quality of pain. When is the pain at night? And if the pain is at night, if you move around, will the pain go? And also where you're profiling the injury, how did it happen? Was it traumatic? Was it insidious? So those questions that too often, I think, as massage therapists and as soft tissue therapists, we have kind of skipped through. It's time we give it the importance that they need to be given, not only, as I said before, to profiling the person and the injury, but also for screening the client, the person, or for screening the condition, the symptoms for red flags. So, but again, once we do that, once we pick up that, I think there might be something here that I think I need to have it looked at or to refer, that's where we need to use the right language with the right, frame it with the right narrative. And I think Becky is quite interested about narrative and the way we discuss. So Becky, I think pass over to you.
So it's a question that comes up a lot, isn't it? It's so if I suspect a red flag in one of my clients, how do I make it clear to them that I very much want them to go and see somebody else without terrifying them? And I think that's particularly important if the client has certain medical histories, because they might be, you know, as soon as you say to somebody maybe who's got a history of cancer, actually, I want you to go and see your GP because of this, it can be really daunting for them, isn't it? And I think there's a couple of practical tips we can maybe give there. And the first one for me is to have that, what we've touched on before, have that open line of communication between yourself and your local healthcare providers, whether that's GPs, physiotherapists, whoever you might have to refer into, so that you can do a referral directly to them, you know, obviously with the client's consent, but you can take that emphasis off the client for having to make the phone call to the GP and try and remember what you've said to them and explain that to the GP. And, you know, so you are able to write to their GP, explain, like we said before, you know, these are the reasons why I'd just like you to take a look at that person. And I think that takes a lot of onus off the client then. But in the terms of the way you communicate that to your client, I think actually we sometimes are quite fortunate with our scope of practice in that we can use that as an explanation as to why we're referring them on. We can say to them, look, this is, I want to make sure that you sit within my scope of practice. And just from the things that you've told me, I just want to make sure there's nothing going on here that would sit outside of that. So what I want to do is for you to see your GP before we carry on with treatment. So you're not, again, it's really important that we don't start saying, I'm sending you to, I think it's really important that you don't start saying, I think I, you know, I'm sending you to your GP because you've got these three things that tell me you might have rheumatoid arthritis. That's absolutely not within our scope of practice. But it's, we can just say, you know, I want you to just have a chat with the GP, and I'm going to write him a letter with my concerns, just so that we know that I'm the right person for you to be seeing. And that almost, I think, just makes it a little bit of a less frightening conversation for the client.
So there you have it. So theory to practice, have that conversation, be mindful of the language that you're using, and absolutely use the subjective and appreciate what the subjective can give you in terms of information regarding red flags that might not be as quite as obvious as, for example, the cord requiner that I gave earlier, and might be more insidious in nature, or might not even have been picked up by the client themselves. Perfect, which then I think brings us onto kind of the final point that is something that came out of us discussing red flags and researching red flags, which is actually red flags are different in different contexts. Now, Becky touched on this earlier, but a red flag for us in clinic may not be a red flag for a surgeon or a physio doing rehab in neuro, because actually that might just be the thing that they're dealing with. And it's totally within their scope of practice to be treating with that symptom or pathology present. Whereas for us, it would be totally inappropriate. And so, you know, Becky made the point that red flags are different in different contexts, and that should be considered when reading things like research or reading literature, or frankly reading anything about red flags, is you've really got to take into account, well, what is the context of the piece as it has been written? Who is it really aimed at? Because if it's aimed at physios, it's going to be slightly different than it's aimed at us. And I think one of the key bits that came out of our conversations is that as massage therapists, our threshold is low, and it should be, and that's a really good thing.
And I almost think, I mean, this is entirely my opinion and not backed by any literature whatsoever, but I almost think we need to, for us, expand that red flag definition of a sign or symptom that might be indicative of a serious pathology, or also a sign or symptom that this person sits without our scope, outside of our scope of practice. So you almost want to think of it, I think, in those two terms. Is it, you know, does this person have the potential for a serious underlying pathology, but also is there something that's raising concern with me that I'm not the right person to be treating them?
Can we please color that flag?
No, there's too many colors, they're all red. Stop it. and being really comfortable with that, again, a bit like we said a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, you know what our scope of practice is. Let's be really proud of that and comfortable in saying to our clients, actually, this just sits a little bit outside of what I deal with, so I'm going to refer you on to whoever who you may be better suited to.
I still think that flag needs a colour, because I think actually it's a really, really good point. Because outside of your scope of practice puts them at risk, I suppose, of having a red flag missed by you, simply because you just don't know enough about that area to know whether that's a good thing or not. But also it does draw back into some of the aspects we discussed as being a good clinician and recognising when you are the most appropriate therapist for that client, whether they're in scope or out of scope. So I stand by wanting to give that. I'm going to give that like a white flag. It's not surrender as such, but it's some sort of like, I might not be the right person for you.
I can't wait for you to write your first letter to a GP saying this person's got a white flag. But, and again, I think that comes down to, danger of repeating ourselves, being well informed, being, you know, having a good basis of knowledge. And again, it harps back to this thing we've said before about doing CPD. We're all quite keen, and I'm one for this as well, to go off and do a nice shiny CPD on the newest technique or you know, something really exciting that we can do with our clients. Even actually some of the, you know, we might specialize in one area of injury, so we look into that. But we mustn't overlook doing these really good CPDs that give us a good foundation as a good clinician. So if that's, I just don't know very much about a certain condition, and I say CPD, you know, you don't need to go on a week seminar about it. Maybe find a podcast about it. Maybe find somebody that's written a blog on it. But just make sure that if you're finding gaps in your knowledge, you're broadening your knowledge around that.
Yeah, you're trying talking to film
about
those.
Yeah, talking about good blogs, I love Jack March blog on red flags, especially inflammatory red flags, rheumatologyphysio.com, absolutely superb resource. And is specific for inflammatory, but again, those one are the one that I think we under refer, or we don't refer quick enough, because the symptoms are so MSK non-specific symptoms, or we think they're non-specific symptoms, and we treat them. By the time we realize and we refer, it's actually too much time has passed.
So I think that probably covers what we wanted to talk about in terms of red flags. As I say, this is going to be, we're going to come back to this, because for us, actually, identifying red flags, knowing what they are, does speak a lot into, again, we've touched on it a lot, scope of practice, and probably even deeper than that, this idea of diagnosis versus assessment, and where do we sit in that spectrum, and is it even a spectrum, or are they two completely different ideals? So we will be touching on this as we go, but I think to summarize for today, when it comes to red flags, first of all, be a good clinician, and that means recognizing when you need to go and polish up on your red flags, but also recognize knowing how to recognize them, understanding what a red flag is and how and what that is versus a contraindication. This is obviously terminology that's thrown around a lot in our industry, but I think we need to be very clear that they are distinct and they do need to be considered separately whilst also considered together, because it's one whole person we're looking at. God, holisticness is very tricky at times, guys. And that red flags are different in different contexts. And as massage therapists, we have one of the lowest, if not the lowest, threshold when it comes to red flags for referral.
That's certainly linked to our scope of practice. Red flags are linked to our scope of practice.
Absolutely. So we're going to go away now, and we're going to get stuck into some fantastic research that we've managed to talk ourselves into around what does it mean to have a scope of practice, how do scope of practices actually vary, and how do we determine our scope of practice, and what does it really mean to diagnose, who is allowed to diagnose, and why do we say we assess and not diagnose. Honestly, the questions we've come out with as part of this have led us down a lot of rabbit holes. And so we're hoping to drag you down with us and hopefully pop out the other side with some reasonable answers. So for today, thank you very, very much for joining us, and we'll speak to you all soon.
As ever, we hope that's been useful for you and thought-provoking. We'd love to hear your thoughts around red flags. And as Matt says, this has highlighted loads of rabbit holes that we want to dive down. So if there's any rabbit holes that you'd like us to explore and chat about on here, please do let us know. We love to hear from you and have your involvement. You can find us on social media at The Massage Collective. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you know when our next ramblings are available for you. And we'll see you soon.